there's a kind of a visceral feeling, a signal that they're not even realizing affects their politics, but they just don't think it's worth it for their children to go into the military anymore.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by John Allen Gay, as we have a conversation with two of the talented people leading the organization Concerned Veterans for America. A quick note. JQAS is holding our summer conference in mid-July. If you're a student, including master's or PhD, or a young professional with less than 2 years of experience in foreign policy, we encourage you to apply. If selected, we'll fly you to Washington, D.C., and you can hear from keynote speakers, scholars in grand strategy, and more awesome programming. This episode is a bit unique for our podcast. This is not only the first time that we've had two guests on, but it's also the first time we've recorded an episode in person. It was a lot of fun and a very lively conversation. Just bear with us if there are some audio issues in this new format. But back to today's show. John Burns is Strategic Director for Concerned Veterans for America. He joined the Marine Corps in 1991 out of high school, served 4 years, and was deployed to Somalia in 1993. He joined the New York National Guard, serving at Ground Zero after the September 11th terrorist attacks, and was deployed to both Iraq and Afghanistan before retiring from the National Guard in 2018. Tyler Kateski is Policy Director for Concerned Veterans for America, a Fall 2020 Marcellus Policy Fellow with JQAS, and now writes about key national security issues, including Ukraine aid, naval policy, and more. Join us as we talk with Tyler and John about how the American veteran community is affected by failures of U.S. foreign policy. Tyler, John, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Well, to start, we have a question for each of you. What is currently the most frustrating thing to you about the Biden administration's foreign policy?
Well, there's a lot to choose from on that front. I think in my mind, generally, it's the theme of this administration sort of aggressively refusing to make any hard strategic choices. Their lack of a real sense that they're interested in prioritizing one region over the other, and that we have to basically keep assistance to Ukraine on autopilot without any regard for the bringing about a strategic outcome that we, you know, support, and is it sustainable for us to fund? You know, in the Middle East, we're basically. We're trying to build a humanitarian aid port while also, supporting Israel. And so I don't see how all of that is, bringing the region to faster stability. And then, in Asia at the same time, despite all of the munitions trade-offs we've got in the Middle East and Europe simultaneously, we are, hard-pressed, I think, to continue to be able to effectively deter in the Indo-Pacific against our greatest long-term military threat, at least in China. What would you say, John?
I was going to kind of hit on the same problems. I was going to say there's a lack of coherence and a lack of an overall strategy. I also think, Biden came from a previous administration whose mantra became don't do stupid stuff. And not only is he kind of doing stupid stuff, but it's also like, it seems like their mantras become like, don't make any hard decisions at all. And, for what's supposed to be, any, but especially a presidential, high ranking, high thinking team, the idea that they don't have any sense of trade-offs and that in 2024, that they think that we still have unlimited resources to do whatever we want around the world. It's mind-boggling that they don't understand that we have trade-offs, that we can't support Israel, make sure that we constrain Iraq from doing anything it wants, support the Ukraine, and again, as you said, still have a strategy that constrains China from becoming a overly dominant hegemon in the Pacific. The fact that they just don't understand that there are resource problems is probably the biggest complaint.
Yeah, it's like we have this sense of 2024 goals with year 2000 means, and it's actually kind of the reverse now in terms of we still have these expansive aims and no longer this post-Cold War latent power to be able to pursue all of them at once, whether they're super core to our national interests or not.
Yeah, maybe it's because President Biden was born like in the 40s that he thinks that... it's still all just good that we have as much resources and as much power vis-a-vis the rest of the world as we did in, say, 1946 or 47.
Yeah, the narrative coming into the Biden administration was like, this is a restoration of normal. And they're restoring or trying to restore a normal from long ago that no longer exists. So, you know, again, built on this assumption that America is this unchallenged power with just so much excess compared to what we're facing from the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, this is not something that's new. It's not something that even somewhat better Democratic administrations have found better solutions for. I remember being in the Marine Corps in 1994 and being in the Marine Corps and of a slightly different, you know, educated level of foreign policy when they switched from the two-war strategy to the war-and-a-half strategy. That was the Clinton administration, right? They realized in 1994 that we just weren't going to be able to continue this idea that we could have two regional wars in two different parts of the world and win and you know, win them both the way we did in World War II simultaneously. It became the idea we would have, if we had to do something like that, it would be one war, and then there would be a holding strategy, an economy of forces, we call it in the military, strategy, where we just had just enough to avoid defeat in the other theater.
And there's this recognition, even in an era where openly pursuing, you could say, you know, liberal internationalist goals and kind of expansive views of U.S. security priorities, but still kind of recognizing what is a realistic amount to be able to commit to.
Yeah, this is only 3 or 4 years after the Gulf War and the New World Order were established.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned World War II. I mean, even in World War II, there was still a hierarchy among the theaters. You know, we saw Europe as the more important, more urgent theater, even though we were waging two great power wars at the same time. But I wanted to pivot over. John, you mentioned some of your prior military service, and you guys are working with this big conservative veteran community. What sentiment about U.S. foreign policy like in the veteran community these days, especially the War on Terror era veteran community?
Well, you know, the veteran community is very mixed on their approach to foreign policy. I think what's interesting is that as we came into the Ukraine war two plus years ago, there was a certain amount of growing consensus in the veterans community that war was generally bad. You saw after the fall of Kabul that many on the right started to move a little bit away from restraint and the idea that we should get out of these wars. That might just have been a growth of the voice of those who always felt that way. But what's really, really interesting is that on the left side of the veterans community, you see this overwhelming idea that we should support the Ukrainians and that we should spend as much money as we need to. And you know, as colleagues have said, fight to the last Ukrainian, bleed Russia out, without any sense that this is a region that, you know, as we all know in this room, that Russia's always going to care more about than we do. And maybe Poland and Germany will care as much about the Ukraine as Russia does, but we just never will.
My connection to this work is that, you know, my dad and uncle were both naval aviators. And I know my dad in particular, and they're both Cold War era, but I know from my dad, just kind of, I think he shared the views of how a lot of veterans ultimately formulated their opinions, which was after 9/11, you know, very ready for us to do what needed to be done to bring Al-Qaeda to justice and, you know, deservedly punish the Taliban for harboring them, and, you know, make sure that there's a huge retributive bloody nose to deter something like that from ever happening again. And then just being completely disillusioned by the decision to then decide to go into Iraq and kind of seeing our credibility squandered on the global stage, you know. And this was still like a very patriotic guy who he, you know, as an airline pilot at the time, helped participate in DoD charter flights to get troops to the Middle East for that invasion, you know. But kind of as the evidence became clear that, you know, there weren't weapons of mass destruction, and we realized kind of the strategic consequences of empowering Iran through the region as well, you know, became very against that conflict, to the point that for a while he basically had an American flag outside his house that he intended to keep up until the day every single American soldier came home from Iraq. And unfortunately, we're still there, even now it's you know, more of a train and equip mission. But I mean, it just goes to show you, I can, from the microcosm of him, I can see how that would have shaped a ton of other people's views. I don't know how your thinking might have altered.
Well, my thinking very much altered over time. As you know, for my storyteller, you know, I was just about done with an undergraduate education, majoring in political science with a focus on IR, international relations. And at the time, I very much, you know, of course, after September 11th, where I reported down to Ground Zero the first evening of that period, and, you know, spent some time on Homeland Security missions over the next year plus, I was very much in favor of the war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. I supported it. I actually went there in 2008. I deployed to Iraq in 2003. And even up till my homecoming in 2008, I was very supportive. But when I was in Iraq, it was 2004, and there was still some sense that we could maybe make it work. And I believe that. At the same time, I had a realization while I was there that, you know, mostly these people are fighting us because we're there, and they really wanted to fight each other. And this was a way of kind of putting that off. What I saw in terms of fraud, waste, and abuse, though, in Afghanistan was even worse. And while it didn't change my mind right away, eventually it got to the point where, and Tyler's heard this story, I don't know if you guys have, but I have a niece who's now 24, and she's in St. John's Law School up in New York. She's going to get her law degree in another couple of months. And she turned 18, and at that point I realized she was old enough to serve in a war that had started before she was 1 year old. She was only a couple of months old when the war kicked off, when September 11th happened. And we had been fighting this war for an entire generation, and it was incredibly, incredibly wasteful. And that, you know, that's reflected into your original question, like, how are veterans and military families, members of the military community, reacting to this? On a visceral level, even if they won't espouse it in their political viewpoints, even if they remain, you know, on the center left focused on helping Ukraine, even if on the center right, you know, they remain either, like, some of them are focused on helping Ukraine or on being restrainers, the military community is slowly but surely discouraging their children from enlisting in the military, right? So there's a kind of a visceral feeling, a signal that they're not even realizing affects their politics, but they just don't think it's worth it for their children to go into the military anymore. And that's really important because, you know, unfortunately, since the end of conscription in 1973, unfortunately in some ways, the military has become a family business. And those who are East Coast educated elites are very, very, always were very hesitant since the 70s to encourage their children to enlist in the military or even to go in as commissioned officers. Even, you know, to the point of discouraging their kids from going to elite schools like the West Point, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Military Academy, going to the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. That was all very discouraged. And it was actually a place where the middle class could get their children into an elite university. But even that's declining now. We see a decline in recruiting. We see a decline in retention. And a lot of that, I think, is reflected of the fact that military families, parents like Tyler's, parents like my father served in the Army during the Vietnam War era, and they're just very, very reluctant to encourage their children to join the military in any way.
Do you think that these military families feel increasingly like the military won't take care of their children?
Well, I think, you know, there's a myriad of causes here. I think one is, yes, I think they see what's going on at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, something that we've been banging the drum about for over a decade at Concerned Veterans for America. They see that the care there is not the same kind of care that was experienced by World War II, Korean, and Vietnam veterans, that the VA has just become, in the terms that everybody in the military community would understand, it's become a self-licking ice cream cone, more interested in perpetuating its own interests than serving the people who it's supposed to serve. I think the way the wars were executed is also a factor that they went on for a very, very long time, and that the American public actually lost interest, right? After September 11th, even during the initial part of the Iraq invasion, there was a high degree of patriotism amongst a broad swath of America. I wouldn't say the leftist, most progressive part of the Democratic Party and that ilk were in favor of the war. Obviously, there were anti-war protests, especially about Iraq. But overall, there was a broad feeling of patriotism in the early post-9/11 era. And that's also gone away.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a shame to see that that good faith, you know, willingness to protect and defend our country. Like, John's a 9/11 first responder and, was, like you were saying, absolutely ready to go in and like kick some well-deserved ass, basically. And, then seeing a lot of our foreign policy decisions in the last 20 years move from clear connection to defending our country from, clear and present dangers to maintaining regional credibility or upholding the rules-based international order. Like, that doesn't do it, I think, for a lot of military families for telling their sons or daughters to, put their lives at risk potentially for, really flawed strategic ideas. And so part of why we think it's important just for our long-term ability to field the all-volunteer military is to make sure that we're only asking them to be called upon to sacrifice when there's that clear connection to what really matters for our security. And I really think that in combination with fixing the Veterans Affairs healthcare system are two things that could really make a dent in the recruiting crisis.
And I mean, you see this, there's a demographic component to this, right? Most of the parents who have, 18, 19, 21 year olds today were, if they are veterans, they were involved in the global war on terror. So it's this particular most recent war that's really set that standard and created that expectation that military life is no longer what I want for my family.
It's been frustrating to see how a lot of kind of what you might call national greatness conservatives, the kind of, warmed over neocons who have a very hawkish foreign policy and want us to be going around and remaking the world, are lamenting the recruiting crisis and pulling out their hair over it, while never connecting it to the strategic choices that they advocated and continue to advocate that put such enormous strain on our military and put people in a lot of situations where the connection between our military activities and the security of Joe Schmo in Idaho was so remote. There's just so little connection in the discourse in Washington. And that kind of relates to another issue, because I've been hearing a lot from folks who are talking to folks who are still in that there's a lot of operational tempo issues in the military even now. Is that accurate?
It's accurate, and it's most acute, I think, in the U.S. Navy, where we went from 3.5 decades ago a 600 ship intention Navy down to 280 operational major warships, that is above, the destroyer or LSW frigate classes. So those 280 ships are required to patrol the same size of the ocean. And we actually have a kind of an increased responsibility for those oceans than we did during the Cold War, right? I mean, during the Cold War, we were faced off against the Soviets. There were actually two major fleets, and things like piracy was at a minimum at that point in some ways, because, there was always somebody, usually, one shadowing the other in almost every part of the ocean. Today, the U.S., has taken on this responsibility to be not the defender of democracy, but the promoter of democracy worldwide and the securer of almost every nation, the securer of all the trade routes. And you're doing this with a much smaller Navy. In terms of the Army and the Air Force, you see that a lot with the, we've talked about this too, the utilization of the National Guard and the reserve component, right? The Army Reserve in particular, but all of the, especially the Army National Guard, the Army Reserve, the Air Force National Guard, the Air Force Reserve. It's less so in the Marine Corps and in the Navy. But those reservists, when we passed things like the Goldwater and Nichols Act back in the 80s, when we came out of Vietnam and the Pentagon came up with a new plan, the Department of Defense came up with a new plan, it was thought that one of the reasons that there were so many protests against the war was that there wasn't enough community buy-in. And the decision was made that we should have a way to integrate the National Guard and the reserves into any kind of ongoing future major wars. And the idea was that they were going to be a strategic reserve. They were supposed to be used for things like the invasion of Afghanistan, fighting the Gulf War, the Iraq War. If that had been justified, it would have been a good use of them. And I was there during it. But what's happened is the Department of Defense has said this is now our operational reserve. So we went from having an occasionally having a battalion or a brigade of National Guard troops doing things like securing the peacekeeping mission in the Sinai or securing the peacekeeping mission in the Balkans sometimes, to now there's routinely deployed operational army brigades and army battalions around the world that are from the reserve component. Same thing with the Air Force. So a lot of their security, police security forces that guard bases come from the reserve component. And this is not what they were designed for. We saw at Tower 22 earlier this year that we lost the lives of three Army reservists. An additional several dozen Army reservists and National Guardsmen were seriously wounded in that attack. And they had no business being there, right? If the active duty component can't secure it, there's no reason to put young working adults and college students on the line because they joined up to fight for their country when their country's security was on the line, to put them at risk because the Pentagon hasn't figured out that they can't do everything in the world. Is just it's literally criminal negligence at this
point. It's been really shocking to see, especially in, you know, in Syria, which is probably like the fringiest of our high risk deployments, that there are just constant guard troops rotating through there, operating in this very dangerous setting. And nobody seems to talk about it back here in Washington or to see anything weird about folks being mobilized to do this kind of stuff, you know, out of communities back in America. So what is the Guard supposed to look like? You know, how is it supposed to be used? Because, you know, we also, you know, you were involved in, I guess it would have been called military assistance to civil authority after 9/11.
That was, you know, that was part of the Guard's role, most of it as a state militia force. So when I patrolled Kennedy Airport, when I patrolled LaGuardia Airport, even during the beginning of the Iraq War, the first 2 months or so of, you know, pre-mission accomplished, when we were fighting and then supposedly securing the territory of Iraq, all of that was done under state active duty. It wasn't even Title 38. It was state active duty, where we were getting a per diem and we were doing it on behalf of the governor of New York State, right? And the National Guard in particular, not the reserve, but the National Guard, both the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard, are supposed to be this dual-hatted military force where they're available to governors for emergencies, for security issues like post 9/11. And again, the Army's just, and the Air Force have just seen them as an operational force. If you go back to before September 11th, you go back to before the transformation of the Army in 2006, the idea was that there were almost two levels of National Guard troops, that while they were all trained to the same standard, they were all, you know, Army troops in their respective MOSs, there were four, what we called at the time, enhanced brigades, who got more money for training, spent more time at the most robust training facilities, things like the Joint Readiness Training Center at Fort Polk, the National Training Center at Fort, or we're in the Combined Maneuver Training Center out in Hohenfels, Germany, which has changed its name. I think it's now the Joint Maneuver. Anyway, those four enhanced brigades were kind of tied to different infantry divisions. For example, the 27th Brigade that I was in for a long time was tied to the 10th Mountain as their roundout brigade. This idea was that they were roundout brigades. And again, that kind of that implies that you're at a point where you need an entire division, and it's been more cost effective, again, after the Clinton drawdown of forces to 1.5 wars, it's more cost effective to have a two brigade division some places and have a roundout brigade, so that by the time they're ready to go overseas for a major war, this third brigade has had 90 days to get ready and stand up and go with them. That was the idea, that they were part of again, strategic reserve, not part of an operational reserve. And since the transformation of the Army is, even in the National Guard, has gone for 20 of the last 23 years. It's kind of starting to go back to the division model again. But brigades were deployed as brigades. And the Army National Guard brigades were deployed in about a three-quarter tempo. So where the active Army was deploying it, you know, once every 3 years, the National Guard brigades were close to a once every 4 year tempo. And it was incredibly draining. I mean, it's one thing to get called up and go, you know, as a police officer or a firefighter or a school teacher to go overseas once because of a major crisis. It's another thing to have to put your life and your career online every 3 or 4 years because of that.
I'm curious, do you think the war on terror is affecting military communities in a unique way compared to past wars? You know, like, there were certainly stresses on military communities through other wars that had questionable long-term goals, like Vietnam. How has the global war on terror in particular, with, you know, relatively fewer people deployed, relatively fewer people killed in active combat, how has that affected military communities uniquely?
Well, I think it gets back to that rotational tempo question we were talking about earlier. I mean, we saw at the, you know, height of the Iraq war, issues like the stop-loss program of, you know, extending people's tours, you know, having people do just like back-to-back deployments. And I think the amount of time some people have been deployed in some of these combat zones compared to previous conflicts is immense, and, you know, arguably contributes to the fact that we've lost more veterans of these wars to suicide than were killed in action. So, you know, one estimate is that, you know, unfortunately, we've lost about 30,000 post-9/11 veterans to suicide. And I think it's understandable how that is a higher risk when we are, you know, basically putting folks on a much higher tempo than in previous conflicts, just given the nature of our rotational system.
Absolutely. One of the big differences between the global war on terror and anything else, and the only wars that come close to the global war on terror in this term of the length, are the Vietnam War and the Indian Wars back in the 19th century. And the Indian Wars don't count. They were fought with very small forces in a whole different time. The Vietnam War comes close, but the Vietnam War was, you know, it was tragic in a different way. It was mostly fought by conscripts. At the time that the Vietnam War started and was kind of rising to the level that it became at the end of the Johnson administration, you still had enthusiastic, patriotic folks who would go to college and commission into the Army and the Navy. And a lot of those officers weren't at that point discouraged even by the deadliness of the Vietnam War. But when you get to the global war on terror, you see a war that has lasted, you know, we talked about it lasting 20 years when we withdrew from Afghanistan, but clearly with what we're seeing in Syria, in places like Nigeria, in the Horn of Africa, it's not really over. We're still doing this, and we're still very close. We're not as bad as we were when we had troops in Iraq, major combat formations in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we still have these forces on a very high rotation. So that discourages people from staying in the way they did when we had a full idea of what a professional military class should do. So as Tyler said, you see folks doing these major or combat deployments on a much higher cycle. And I talked a little bit about how that affects folks in the reserve component, but that's just as bad on the active duty side. So you have folks who every 3 years, they're gone for somewhere between 8 and 15 months. They don't see their kids play sports those years. They don't get to see their spouses those years. That's creating a lot of divorce, which might feed into the recruiting crisis, right? Because you're hearing from two different sides. You give up a lot of your life every time you deploy. Even when I was in the Marine Corps, I was in Okinawa. It wasn't a deployment. It was just a regular rotation to Okinawa. And for the first time, but not the last time in my military career, I sensed a real disconnect with the cultural life in America. You miss things, right? You get movies 4 weeks later than they come out in America. You get limited one channel where basically the military decides what you're, at the time anyway, now we have streaming, but in 1992, the military decides what goes on AFN, Armed Forces Network. So you're missing out on some television shows, some television premieres. You're missing out on some major kind of, and at the time we had a much better culture of it, like news culture, the curation of news where, you know, and I won't say it was even-handed in 1992, but it was more even-handed than we see today. It was before the rise of Fox News, at the time the most, you know, colorful and dominant conservative commentator in the media was Rush Limbaugh. He wasn't as imitated as he became over the next, you know, couple of decades. I saw it again in Iraq when I was there for 9 months, that we would get videos late. We wouldn't understand what was happening back in America. So you do that to somebody 4 times in the course of 20 years of an active duty military career. And that's another reason they're going to discourage their children from joining the military. They just, it no longer becomes fun. And you just had, until recently, you just had to stick it out if you wanted that pension. And, you know, if you got to 12 years, you would join the military in your late teens or early 20s. It was almost impossible to commit to not committing to that 20th year. Because if you do that, you look at your spouse. If you commit to going to 20, you're going to be getting a full pension at 38, 40, 41, 42. And if you don't do that, you know, like if I was in that situation, like I wouldn't have to worry about the military killing me, combat killing me. My wife would have killed me, right? So, you know, you stretch it out, but then you realize you look back and, you know, you miss 25, 30% of your kid's life. You miss 25 or 30% of your marriage. And it's, you know, it's incredibly irresponsible of people, especially politicians who've never served in the military, to do that to the people that they really should be counting on to defend their security. And instead, in many cases, as we've mentioned, they're using them to promote very fringe causes. They're using them to promote their Wilsonian idea of spreading democracy around the world. And, you know, as friends of ours that we've, you know, read, like John Hulsman, Patrick Porter have pointed out, you can't spread democracy at the point of a bayonet. And we're not the first ones to say that, right? I mean, that axiom has been around before.
I'm curious about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, because you cited that as something that people will sometimes refer to as the end of the war on terror, although we've, you know, been talking about how that's not quite the case. Why was the Afghanistan withdrawal important? And also, I'm curious, what role did CVA play in that?
Well, I think the conflict was just emblematic for the turn that entire concept of the global war on terror just took in American culture, of this initial sense that it was justified, which, of course, you know, going in at the start to take retribution for the worst terror attack in American history, absolutely. But then, you know, Afghanistan was, I think, a microcosm for everything else, of just the long-term transition to it being this untenable, you know, nation-building mission with no clear military solution. You know, a lot of disjointed humanitarian efforts going on concurrently, developmental assistance, basically feeding a culture of corruption rather than preventing that. And basically, and also just the accountability for, you know, what we saw in the Afghanistan papers of senior commanders misleading the American public about the progress of the war on the ground, and that directly contradicting the assessments that were being gathered from folks who were there. And, you know, none of these people really suffering sort of professional consequences whatsoever, and people being very happy to just kind of keep this conflict on autopilot rather than making the hard choice of pulling U.S. forces out to focus on more important priorities for our security. You know, so CVA for several years before the final withdrawal was making the strategic case for leaving Afghanistan, and, you know, no longer diverting all the resources to that conflict that we did. And if anything, you know, making this more of a strategic burden for our adversaries like China and Russia long term, which, you know, we've started to see now in the aftermath of that. And I think there's been a lot of focus on the withdrawal and the way it was poorly handled or poorly planned and executed rightly deserves scrutiny and accountability for those responsible. But what too often gets lost in the conversation, I think, is just how overdue it was in the first place. And so we, we had an endless wars campaign for many years that was building that strategic case to get out and showing that increasing numbers of the American public were growing disenchanted with this war. And then also on the flip side, though, we supported the creation of the Afghanistan War Commission to make sure that there was accountability both for that disastrous withdrawal planning and execution, but also for the strategic choices that led us to stay there for two decades in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's there was a raw sense of betrayal by members of the military, the veteran community, military family members in August of 2021. The end of that war really, for families who had been invested in it one way or another in that generation, in the last two generations really of the military, there was a sense that it was awful. And of course, you know, President Biden couldn't have screwed up the ending any worse. But, you know, to some degree, I blame that on the military and the civil military culture that has evolved over the past couple of decades, where not just the American people who are now starting to lose their trust in the military, which is another you know, discouraging trend because of the global war on terror and everything we've done, but the political class here in the Beltway, they have changed from very, very skeptical to very, very accepting of military judgment, the judgment of the Joint Chiefs and the Pentagon. And that's disturbing. The only good thing about it is I think outside of this administration, certainly, you know, in a big part of the right side of Congress, you're starting to see much, much more of a skepticism around what military planners think in terms of grand strategy, right? They just don't trust them on that anymore to a big degree. I know that, you know, I've said this before, but, you know, as terrible as the execution was of the withdrawal, those 13 Marines who never should have been in the danger they were in, who shouldn't have died in that last bombing, they were the last Americans who died in Afghanistan. And that's a good thing, even though they should never have died. To Tyler's point, I mean, I just get viscerally angry at the fact that not just for the Afghan withdrawal, but for the last two decades, and probably even reaching back to the 90s, the culture has changed where military commanders aren't held accountable at all. You know, General Miley is one of them that, you know, really frustrates me. But you've seen this from, you know, from Fat Leonard to Milley to, you know, just a lack of accountability to anyone. You know, the last generals that were really held accountable for anything were McChrystal and Petraeus. And one was held accountable for essentially assaulting by default the president in the paper, the other for stuff that was related mostly to an extramarital affair and had something to do with his top secret access. But the folks who did that, the folks who screwed up many other things in the military, have never been held accountable. If you go back to, you know, World War II, you would lose your command if you were incapable. You go back to Korea, you know, and a president who disagreed with the commander on the ground, fired the commander on the ground when the commander on the ground thought that he knew more than the president did. You go to the Kennedy administration and you still see, tragically in some ways, McNamara being the definitive voice at the Department of Defense. But, you know, that civil military position was reinforced during the Kennedy administration, came very close during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, with lunatics like Curtis LeMay, you know, having to be like restrained. It's a joke in Dr. Strangelove that they have to physically restrain the character based on him. But, you know, if you read 13 Days, there was like a lot of intellectual restraint, you know, from McNamara to McGeorge Bundy to Adlai Stevenson, just having to, you know, over and over again tell President Kennedy, just do not listen to this lunatic.
Well, and just to amplify what we were talking about the shift in the culture, you know, the general officers who have failed to deliver, now you also see those general officers are like the people that exclusively get to talk about foreign affairs on places like CNN, MSNBC, et cetera, you know, that they are pretty much the only voices allowed to talk about security and strategy. When not only the record of the general officer class in the last couple of decades has not been stellar, but there's also kind of a survivorship bias and a selection effect of who gets to that level in the military too. Like there's a culture and there's relationships that exist that help shepherd people's careers along who are going to make senior officer levels like that.
Yeah. And junior officers and NCOs and enlisted troops, they recognize that. They realize, you know, when you join the military at whatever level you come in at, you're told, you know, integrity and moral courage are a big part of what it means to be in the military, holding yourself accountable. If you don't hold yourself accountable, you'll be held accountable. And down below the, you know, the general officer level, that's usually true. At the general officer level, you see less and less accountability this way. And the troops, you know, even the troops who are retired, even the troops who are veterans, not retired, they see that. And again, this is another part of the trend against, or the trend downward of American trust in the military. It's a trend downward in the trust that American military members and veterans have of their so-called seniors there. And again, there's no accountability. These people are making terrible decisions. Part of it is the, you know, the kind of small p politicization of bureaucratic culture in America over the last 75, 80 years. And part of it is the way that the military does business, in that they are rated by their direct senior. And we have this culture of a political military careerist class where they want to get to that general officer level. They want to get that $180,000 a year pension for the rest of their life. And in doing so, they're risking their career is the biggest risk they see. And so the way it works in the military, and Tyler might know this from his father, is you get promoted when your senior leader picks you as the number one of his three or four or five junior officers. And senior officers is risk averse to anything that's going to hurt his career. So he picks for promotion that officer who will do the least amount of damage to his career. And that risk averseness just trickles down. And that's how you get an army in Iraq that could have done a lot more to defeat the insurgents as they were. We still would have had the terrible problem of winning the political piece, but we could have defeated the insurgents where they were to a great degree if we hadn't chosen to drive up and down the road and make targets of ourselves because we didn't want to take the fight to them, because that was considered by many, you know, colonels and junior generals as being riskier than actually going to fight the enemy. And you see that across the way we fought in Afghanistan, the way we fought in Iraq, and there are very few pockets of the military where you don't see that.
What are the kinds of issues that CVA is focusing on today? I know that you've talked a bit about Ukraine aid, but also the existing deployments. Some of it makes sense, you know, having troops just sitting in Al-Tanf as targets for missiles. That makes a lot of sense why veterans would be opposed to that. But why would things like Ukraine or American capabilities to deter an invasion of Taiwan by China, why are these things also relevant to veterans?
Sure. Well, we recently released our kind of set of policy priorities for the year, and they more or less filter down into three main categories. So there's, you know, fixing veterans' healthcare in America and making sure that folks who use the VA for their healthcare aren't just basically trapped in a increasingly broken system that hasn't changed nearly enough since the Phoenix VA scandal, which happened 10 years ago. By the way, the deal with that was that the VA had a public wait list that showed short wait times for veterans and then a secret paper wait list that showed way longer wait times, and at least 40 veterans died waiting for care because the wait times were far longer, and we just did some events commemorating that anniversary. And so we want to see veterans have more choice to use their health benefits at community care providers, which are alternatives to VA facilities. And we hope that that can make sure that we're focusing on the veteran, not necessarily a specific system, and keep our promise to those who have served. So there's the veterans piece. Then on foreign policy in general, we just want to rethink the overall paradigm that we have towards a more prudent, you know, restrained and, you know, realist informed foreign policy. You know, in particular, that means a critical look at some of our security commitments abroad, you know, making sure that we are, that our role in NATO is kind of right-sized given the strategic challenges we face, you know, growing in Asia that are basically eclipsing the strategic importance of Europe long-term.
What does that mean, right-sized?
I would say that, you know, we are basically providing most of Europe's forward defense right now. And so we're you know, we have like 100,000 troops roughly in Europe, I think by the last available data. And, you know, despite the fact that Europe collectively, you know, dwarfs Russia's economy, has, you know, much more manpower, better military technology, they haven't mustered the political will to ever really take full responsibility for their own security, even though Russia is, or even though they're in a better position to do so than ever before, given that, one, Russia has showed its cards and showing that it's willing to be aggressive abroad, but two, that it has destroyed a ton of its combat power in this disastrous war in Ukraine. And so if there was ever a time for Europe to step up more in its role in NATO to take the main burden of that frontline defense and for the U.S. to transition to a more kind of logistical support role and sort of, you know, reinforcement of last resort rather than it being, you know, U.S. troops in the Baltics all the time, as opposed to other NATO members, you know, that's what we mean kind of by that right sizing. And so basically just this sense that while, you know, America's partnerships and alliances are important and they do give us an advantage, they need to be advancing American security interests and not just ends in themselves to have these to begin with. We got to make sure that we choose them wisely and don't enter into new ones, especially, you know, permanent ones. So, you know, for instance, adding Ukraine into NATO, as a lot of people have talked about, or potentially providing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia a security guarantee, as the Biden administration has proposed. You know, we don't want to be entering into new alliances that don't have a clear connection to improving our ability to protect our vital security interests. And then lastly, the other kind of broad plank is thinking about our economic strength kind of in the dime context. So diplomacy, information, military, and the economy as all facets of our national power, and trying to make sure that we are not sapping our economic strength by, for instance, restricting our ability to support or to export liquid natural gas to Europe, which is a vital alternative to Russian pipeline gas right now after the war in Ukraine. Or to make sure that we're on a stable spending trajectory, since right now we have interest alone on our $34 trillion national debt this year eclipses our entire defense budget. And so our serious fiscal trajectory is an issue that's not going away and is going to eventually force some of the grand strategic changes that we need to make in order to be able to credibly maintain some of these commitments. And so we're trying to make sure that we take the proactive actions now to more safely adjust to these new constraints rather than be faced with the chaotic potential future scenario of having to do these without the choice to manage it as securely as possible.
Yeah, I think the last part, Tyler, is one of the biggest whys, right? It's the economic picture. So right now with a country at $27 trillion in debt...
I think it's 34.
I thought I saw 27 today, but it's certainly up there in the 30 trillion range. And with a country that in debt, we're taking money from the taxpayers and we're spending it to reinforce Ukraine, which again is not technically an ally. It's not a member of NATO. We are, at the time we're doing that, drawing down supplies of ammunition and weapons that we really can't afford to draw down if we mean to reinforce our allies in the Indo-Pacific as well. We're doing it with all of that debt, with taxpayer monies that we're using, and we're doing it with not the kind of industrial base that we had in, say, 1945 or 1950 or even 1965. Our industrial base, while we're still, you know, a great industrial power in a lot of ways, we don't have the defense industry that we had. It's consolidated from hundreds of companies down to four or five big ones. And of that, the shipbuilding capacity has virtually left the country. I think the only successful shipbuilding that we really have left is the Electric Boat Company up in Connecticut, making submarines, which are still world class. But we've had a disaster with the littoral combat ship system, where the Navy just threw away money on a bunch of boats that can't do one of the three things that they were supposed to do and are not anywhere near modular applications that they are, to the point where we're buying frigates from France probably for our next generation. But we're going to have to spend money to produce artillery shells, to produce anti-tank missiles, to produce anti-air missiles that we count on for strategic deployment of our troops when necessary, that we've given away to the Ukrainians at a time where, rather than trying to build those munitions back, the money that we spend on defense should really be going to building a new generations of ships, to securing what the future of the Air Force is going to look like. And instead, we got to buy the basic, you know, bombs and bullets because we've been giving them away. So we're not making hard choices. Again, we're looking at an administration, a bureaucratic, entrenched bureaucracy, administrative state at the Department of Defense that just thinks that there are no limitations to the resources that we have. So, this encroaches on not just our debt and the fiscal state of the federal government, but that has impacts downstream on the average American, right? So while it's great to have a Ukrainian flag on your front lawn, if you think of the implications that has on things like inflation and reducing, you know, what your wage is worth at the grocery store, I think Americans would have a very different mindset about supporting the Ukrainians if they knew how much it was really costing them at home.
We've talked a bit about the Navy, but Tyler, I want to get some of your views on it as well. You've written a good deal about U.S. naval policy over the years, including as a Marcellus Policy Fellow back in 2020. And you also recently wrote a piece about the Navy's lack of at-sea missile reloading capabilities. What were you concerned about 3.5 years ago? And what have you recently been concerned about in terms of the state of the U.S. Navy and its ability to defend American national interests?
Well, first off, I have to thank John Gay and JQAS for coming up with the Marcellus Policy Fellowship right in the middle of COVID. It gave me a lot more to do than I otherwise would have been able to occupy myself with. And basically, that paper, and yeah, like the fall of 2020, was basically talking about how if you accept the premise that we would be better off, broadly speaking, with, say, an offshore balancing grand strategy of the United States, mostly instead of being heavily forward deployed in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia simultaneously, that it would focus mostly on being a balancer of last resort and making sure that its key allies and partners in all of these regions were equipped to maintain the balance of power or to do so long enough for us to come and assist. And so starting from that premise, based on what we've talked about just now about growing economic and strategic constraints that limit our ability to continue this sort of deep engagement, heavily forward deployed presence credibly into the future, that we need to think about how to operationalize that in practice. And so in my mind, the Navy is the most important branch for being able to execute an offshore balancing strategy, because in order to balance, you have to get there. And so the paper focused on things like our shipyard capacity and basically the ongoing shipyard infrastructure optimization program, which is still ongoing, and the GAO has criticized them for not having good enough cost estimates and everything. But, you know, just basically like the idea, speaking also to the operational tempo questions we brought up, that like, we have gigantic maintenance delays for our fleet, even in peacetime. So, you know, God forbid what would happen the second we needed to just add even one more ship that was battle damaged into existing queues that we can't already meet, and what that does to the demands on our troops already. You know, and other things like our sea lift capacity. So our ability to, you know, transport the millions of tons of cargo we would need to fight in a, you know, high intensity conflict anywhere. I forget what the exact footprint for the exact cargo footprint for Desert Storm was, but I think the logistical requirement is something like 1.5 million square feet of cargo for
millions, maybe even billions of tons.
Yeah. And there's just no way to do this at scale, like with airlift, frankly. You know, you can get your troops there, you can get them some supplies, but as far as just the right cost per ton deployed and everything, it's, you just can't replicate it the way you can with sea lift capacity. And, you know, that's just something we're kind of running into with this pier in Gaza and everything as well. And unfortunately, our sea lift capabilities are, you know, aging, and this, you know, has to do as well just with our declining industrial base. But so it talked about, you know, ways that you could potentially extend the life of current ones, think about ways to repurpose existing commercial vessels and things like that. You know, and then also talking about our fleet structure. And so again, part of getting to the place we have to balance, you know, you want to have a fleet optimized to its greatest potential threat, which would be the People's Liberation Army Navy for China, and also their on the mainland, the extensive anti-access area denial capabilities that the PRC has. And it focused a little bit just on how we have, and this is, you know, not a new concept in naval discourse, but just that we have a lot of exquisite, super expensive weapon systems that, while very capable and useful to have, are super hard to replace. And the idea that we need to think about how to have more expendable, replaceable surface vessels that can carry more missiles. You know, essentially our offensive anti-ship capability largely comes down to our ability to launch carrier strike groups. And that's a problem long-term against an opponent like China. And so we're basically trying to talk about what would some of those targeted investments look like, and you know, how do you pay for them in ways that can make this all sustainable? And so you have to look at trade-offs with, like, how many brigade combat teams do we have in the Army, for instance, depending, like, is, you know, stopping, we're no longer worried about Soviet tanks coming through the Fulda Gap, and we're hoping that Europe can step up more. And so, you know, long-term, shift that existing pool of resources more towards the potential adversary that only the U.S. is most capable to deal with, and that would be China. And so then, yeah, more recently on talking about reloading missile magazines at sea, so our you know, Arleigh Burke destroyers and our cruisers, you know, they use what's called the vertical launch system as their principal missile magazine. So that came out in 1986, which was when my dad commissioned into the Navy, I believe. And since then, we have not been able to find a reliable way to reload it anywhere other than at port. And while the VLS system is a great capability, it's super modular, you can put all kinds of different munitions in it. You know, if you're China, the first thing you do is knock out every single port, you know, basically west of Hawaii that can service anything or any of our VLS reloading needs, to then force the already outnumbered surface combatants we have to go all the way back to to Pearl Harbor or even the continental United States to be able to get into a fight. And so I think there was a Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment study a few years back that estimated that we would, in that high-intensity naval conflict with China, if it ever, you know, God forbid happens, we would go through like 360 missiles a day, which is like close to 11,000 in a month. And so, you know, it's great if you can fire off your entire, you know, missile inventory, as we've kind of seen in the Red Sea with Prosperity Guardian. There was, you know, on January 12th, we launched like 80 Tomahawks in one day when we were, you know, striking various targets across the Middle East. But we only bought 53 Tomahawks last year. So it's both a stockpile issue and a reloading issue. Even if we had enough of these munitions, which is a tenuous proposition given the way we've you know, been offering a lot of various munitions to Ukraine and other places. If you only have, you know, one magazine in a missile fight and then you have to leave for several weeks to go and rearm, that's effective combat power that's no longer deployable. And so I think it was like there was an estimate from CSBA that the impact of a reliable at-sea rearming capability would be something like 18 surface vessels effectively more available in a contingency like that.
Yeah. How many vertical launch cells do you have on a typical ship?
So I believe it's about 96, and it can be up to 112.
There are four different classes, yeah. 40 different iterations of the Arleigh Burkes. So
yeah, so it kind of it depends on what the specific hole is. But again, I think particularly the Red Sea right now has shown us, you know, when you're dealing with swarms of several dozen drones at once, you know, those magazines can empty out pretty fast. And, you know, that's actually, it's a whole other budgetary trade-off of we're going to shoot a $2 million missile at a $2,000 drone.
Yeah, while I don't generally appreciate everything that somebody like Jerry Hendricks has to say, the crisis of our Navy is something that just isn't getting enough attention. You know, there's confusion. We've been talking about the Arleigh Burke. It is literally the workhorse of the Navy. It's become, as a power protection tool, it's become more important even than our aircraft carrier fleet, I believe. And it is aging technology. It is also confusing because it's not really a destroyer. So if you look at the size and the firepower capability of Arleigh Burke's, it's virtually identical in terms of firepower and displacement as the Ticonderoga class cruisers that were built before it. And we haven't built anything smaller in terms of fighting vessels. And again, this is why, you know, the littoral combat ship was a disaster. It was supposed to be a frigate. So something smaller than a cruiser, something smaller than a destroyer, but still had the ability to defeat local forces, still had the ability to show the flag, still had the ability to do counter-submarine missions, counter-air missions, the ability to do counter-piracy missions, rather than forcing these large surface ships to be doing all of that at the same time. And we need to find a way to replace that capability. We need to find a way to improve the destroyer cruiser capability. And those Arleigh Burke's, you know, they're a lot of them are getting to the end of their service life. So we're talking about leaving a huge gap there in the near future. I remember reading a paper that was about air power that kind of relates to this. It wasn't, you know, it was air power, not naval power. But the author was talking about how the fact that these fifth generation fighters, the F-22 and the F-35s, were great, but we could only build so many of them. And same thing in a major war, you know, you're going to lose some of them. The ability to keep them, you know, maintained and up in the air, the longer a war goes on, those are very, very technical parts. And he had the solution of we should just go back to building F-16s, right? It's the simplest thing that we can build quickly, and it still has enough lift, enough kind of combat power, and enough ability to exist in kind of the second part of a major power conflict. When you take out most of the high-tech fighters, when you take out most of the high-tech anti-air weapons, and same thing with the Navy. I'd rather see the Navy go back to building frigates from the 1970s and 80s than I would, you know, something like the littoral combat ship system. You know, they had a problem with again, we're looking to export the production of our next line of frigates to France with the Fregue. And again, the Navy's making this mistake. They want different models. They want one for anti-submarine and one for anti-air, where what they really need is a Swiss Army knife at that size.
I mean, you know, and there's been concepts kind of addressing these munitions trade-offs going back decades too, with things like the arsenal ship as an idea. And so, you know, one thing I mentioned in the MPF paper was the idea that, you know, basically you could get a lot more VLS capacity for the dollars you would spend on a single Ford class carrier, or forget the exact number, but just, you know, far more basically converted merchant ships with a bunch of containerized cruise missiles, and talking about, you know, up to like even several hundred munitions if you wanted to. And, you know, none of this is to say that we should be courting great power conflict or anything like that, particularly with China. You know, it would be devastating to the world economy and to both of our economies in particular. But that one of the ways that we can help deter the possibility of that is to make sure that what we do spend is done so wisely towards being most effective, but also supporting the kind of grand strategic choices to be that would make that conflict less likely and to make our ability to be offshore more credible.
Tyler Kotesky, John Burns, thank you for coming on Security Dilemma.
Thanks very much.
Be happy to come back and talk more about this anytime.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Apply to the JQAS Summer Conference by May 7th. Remember to rate and review on your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.